Laughing Eyes Kennel presents The Gypsy Musher with Iditarod and Yukon Quest veteran Hugh Neff. The Gypsy Musher will share stories from the trail, fortune-telling, and memories of mushing years past. Follow The Gypsy Musher on Twitter and visit our website at gypsymusher.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, hosting from Willow, Alaska, and on the line calling in from New Orleans, Louisiana, is the Gypsy Musher himself, Hugh Nephew. How's it going?
Just being a gypsy.
Just being a gypsy. Very good. So you are down in New Orleans. You've made your way pretty much in a circular fashion around the eastern part of the country. How has the tour been for you? What have you seen? What have you learned? How's George? Lay it all out for us.
Well, right now, Nicole and I, she just flew down and met me in Houston, and we drove here from Houston about a 5.5-hour drive. We're staying at a hotel just about a block and a half from Bourbon Street in the French Quarter. It's called the Olivier House. Pretty neat, old school. You know, I've never been to this part of the country before, so it's another world to me. It's sort of touristy, but luckily I got lucky today. A fellow I know through Iditarod, who's a volunteer, contacted me yesterday, Walter Herman, and said, "Hey, you want to do lunch?" And from there, he showed us all around town and took us down to St. Charles, where all the old school mansions are, and showed us, took me actually to the cemetery this morning so I could see where my distant relatives were buried. So been a whirlwind day here. We're going to be here for another night, and then we're going to check out more of the old school Louisiana and go to something a little bit quieter. We're going to go to Lafayette and try to listen to some old school Cajun music. New Orleans is cool, you know, but it is a city, so I can only handle a city for about a day or so, and then I got to get out of town.
Right. So last night you headed over to a haunted hotel, you had said. Tell us about that, and have you seen some of that voodoo culture that they have down there in that part of the country?
Oh, I didn't head over to one. I'm staying in one.
Oh, you're staying. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. That's awesome.
Yeah, I don't know if it's cool. I haven't seen anything yet, but you know, it's really neat. And, I just love the design here. It reminds me a lot of Europe in a way. It's very old school. I mean, it's such an amazing history to America that, you know, was created by the French people, really, and really, you know, the whole Louisiana Purchase and a lot of the U.S. You know, was founded by folks like Lafayette and. A lot of, you know, this area is incredibly influenced by the French as well as the Catholic religion, mixed in with other religions, of course, like from Africa and the Caribbean, voodoo, stuff like that. I haven't really looked into that stuff that much, but you definitely see everything around here. It's a big city, though, so you got to be careful. We're being precautionary and getting lots of advice about things to check out. But realistically, wherever I go, the only places I really want to see are not, you know, clothing stores. I want to go see the local forest and fauna and, you know, the wildlife, stuff like that.
Right. So can you tell us again, I know you talked about it on a show or two before, and you just mentioned you saw where your relatives or your ancestors were buried down there. What's the story? What was your grandmother's name, Mama Dixie or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. And then her father, I believe, is either her father or grandfather. I get it all mixed up. My little sister, Teresa, has it more in detail than I do, was actually the editor for the New Orleans Picayune, the paper here. And then she actually ended up marrying my grandfather, who ended up being the editor of the newspaper in New York, in Poughkeepsie, New York. So definitely got some media in the background, but I think the media back then was probably quite a bit different from the gossipy type of media we have nowadays. But it's pretty fascinating. Her grandfather was actually a guy named Leopard, and he was actually the fellow that was the pirate captain. They didn't really call him necessarily pirate captains or sea captains, but he was actually killed in a mutiny in Costa Rica back in the 19th century, early 19th century. So like I was talking to some girl earlier today, you know, I'm sure there's lots of folks that have relatives around here that were related to pirates in one fashion or another. So it's just an awesome history down here. And it's really cool to finally make it here after all these years of wanting to come down here.
Right, right. Cool. So you had mentioned right before air that that George is taking a breather from the trip with you and kind of kicking back in the air conditioning back in Houston. How has he fared throughout this trip? I've seen a lot of pictures of the little guy there, always smiling in the pictures. Looks like he's having a great time. How's it been traveling with George for the last couple of weeks?
Well, he's got about 3,000 girlfriends at last count.
Very good.
So many people love him up. He's enjoying the AC. Obviously, I didn't really want to have him in such a, busy areas, this area is here. So he's chilling back in Sugarland, which is where my buddy Bernie and his sister Marie and her husband Mark have been watching out for George. So George obviously is ready to get back home and see his brothers and sisters. Walter and George, big difference is that Walter is amazing with all type of creatures, whether they be puppies or humans, where George can tell he really, from day one, really missed his brothers and sisters and stuff. I really wanted to bring
his
two dogs.
Pack.
I think it would have been better for the dogs, but realistically with traveling, it just would have been too much. So I'm a big believer, though, that something that Lance told me a long time ago is if you have a great leader, the more time you spend with them, the greater bond you create, the greater of a dog they become. And I'm it's more than just genetics or what have you. It's just something, magical to me. And that's why I really think our bond is even greater now. And I think, he might be eight. That might be old for most people as far as dogs go. But for me, I think he's in the prime of his career right now. So it's been a really awesome experience sharing not only George with others, but the love that I have with George. I think people can sort of tell that we got a really amazing bond. And it's been tough not having Walter here. Everybody's been asking about Walter, but realistically, he is a little bit older. But it was quite ironic
right.
that I had a guy named Walter showing me around New Orleans. I had to laugh about that.
Of course. So the last time we spoke, you were spending time with Ken Huff. That's his name, right?
Oh, yeah, the football player. A good buddy from
football player.
For the Colts and the Redskins.
From way back in the day in the Redskins there in North Carolina. And if I remember correctly, a couple of days ago you had – a recent NFL star hanging out with you. Who was that, Jacoby Jones?
Yeah, I didn't, to be quite honest, even know who the guy was until I Googled his name, and it said that he had the longest touchdown in history, 109 yards, and then he caught a touchdown to win a game in the playoffs, then he caught another touchdown in the Super Bowl. So, nice kid. He's like, I think he's going to be 29 or 30. He's a free agent now. We were at a Memorial Day party, and he and a buddy, Smith, what the heck was his first name? Jim Smith, maybe? I can't remember, but he plays for the Ravens. And they come and hung out. And the one guy that played for the Ravens, he was a little bit shy around the dog, and you can tell he's a little nervous, where Jacoby couldn't stop touching him, and he kept on going, is this an alpha dog? Is this an alpha dog? And I said, yeah, he's alpha. So it was pretty cool. And who knows down the line if I get to see him again, but it was cool for him to – he was really into it. There's another guy, Micah Petrie, who played in college. He has a bar, actually, in that area, and he's a big-time Denver Broncos devotee. He knew all about Iditarod and everything, so we came over and he got to meet George and everything, so that was pretty awesome.
Cool stuff.
People don't realize,
the
Iditarod might not be huge financially, but people around the world do know about it.
Of course, and in your travels, you seem to run into all sorts of folks,
yeah.
and they all somehow or another they know about the race, even folks that you're not, necessarily associated with, right?
Yeah. Before we forget, we should definitely talk a little bit about the family that I visited in Austin that I stayed with. I did a talk at Eanes Elementary, the oldest school in Texas. Laura Wright was the Iditarod teacher on the trail this year, so I talked to her school. And I really went there to see the Etten family, whose son, unfortunately, has some issues with a brain tumor. He's a young boy. And
right.
I got to hang out with them. They're formerly from the Chicago area. But what was amazing about that story is at the end of the show, it was their last day of school, and they had a half a day. So I was like their last class. And to keep those
they
kids
were ready to get
under
out
control,
of
Oh, it was the energy level was out of control. I felt like I was in New York City. But anyways, at the end of the show, a little girl comes up, a third grader, and she goes, "My dad wanted me to give you his book. He signed it, and so did my class." And the guy's name is actually Douglas Brinkley, and he's a well-known author of historical novels. He wrote a great book called The Wilderness Warrior about my favorite president, Teddy Roosevelt, who founded a lot of our national parks. Anyhow, I carried this book in the Kobuk 440 a couple of years ago, and then 2 years later, the author of the book sends me a copy of his latest book, which is actually about Alaska. So it was pretty strange. But who knows? Maybe I'll get to meet him. Go ahead.
Pretty soon you're going to be on Ellen. That's your next.
All right.
wasn't that book written about Alaska back in the day, like in the 60s or something like that? I don't recall what the cover said.
Yeah, exactly. And I haven't read the book yet. Obviously, I just got it a couple of days ago. But it's all talking about how we're going to be able to preserve the most beautiful part about the U.S. that I think there is. And obviously right now with what's going on in Juneau and whether people are going to be keeping their jobs and the way the oil industry is now, it's a dicey situation. So hopefully things will improve. And that's what's funny about my buddies that I'm hanging out with Houston. They're all tied in with the oil business too, and they're all a little bit, nervous. But, you just got to persevere whether you're in the oil business or a dog musher. Life isn't always going to go your way. You just got to figure out a way to get through the tough times and keep a bright outlook on what's up with lies ahead.
So you're heading back to Alaska at the end of the week. I think you said Saturday, right before airtime. Then you're heading back up to Tok to start your summer activities with the talks there at the hotel and all of that. Anything else? You had mentioned you're heading back through some of the smaller towns in Louisiana. Are you done from there? Are you driving back to Chicago, or what are you doing after?
No, we're flying. We're flying.
New Orleans
trip? We're flying. Nicole and I are flying straight back on Alaska Airlines, which thankfully is quite a bit cheaper.
From Texas.
From Houston, through Seattle.
Yeah.
It's
okay.
About five times
so
as
that,
cheap.
That's this week.
Sending a dog through Alaska Airlines. So I want to give kudos to Alaska Airlines for being way above the ball as far as animal welfare when it comes to flying with dogs. The other airline Houston was not a pleasant experience at all.
Yeah, Alaska is awesome, and we deliver service dogs throughout the country. We always use Alaska Airlines, and in fact, we're delivering one down to San Antonio, pretty close to where you were there in Austin this summer ourselves. So, Hugh, while I have you on, I'm sure you thought I was going to ask you about this, and you are allowed to talk. According to the Iditarod rules, we're in that window right now, so you are allowed to talk. Following the internet, a lot of folks are talking, good, bad, and indifferent, about the new rule with the cell phones and coaching. I don't know if you read Danny Seavey's post where he says that, they're going to take advantage of it and, call ahead on the trail and do all that sort of stuff. And he said, as well as the ADN said, it's pretty much a death sentence to the smaller kennels, and they listed people like Nick Pettit and Wade Mars and folks like that. What is your take on this new rule with you allowed to have the cell phones, the sat phones, all that sort of stuff? You think it's good, bad, or indifferent?
Yeah, pretty indifferent on it. I mean, rules are like laws. People are going to find a way to get around them anyways, and I think everybody's
right.
Knows as far as Iditarod that hopefully it can, it just needs to be, where's the love anymore? And there's just so much negative energy. I don't read any of the stuff these guys are writing. And a lot of these guys are writing are guys that don't even race anymore. So, I mean, the negative energy that's happening with that race, just test it. There's got to be a way. We have to have, what we should be concentrating on is not phones, but relations with villages, how to have the native people of Alaska be more into it. And, a lot of us are wondering how much more we want to deal with races that are not anything like the dreams we once had about what they were going to be like. They're not the Iditarod of 10 or 20 years ago. And it's sort of, when's the last time we ever talked about dogs when it comes to our Iditarod? I love Iditarod. I live for it. I mean, I my feet have been nearly on every piece of that trail, kicking and running and ski pulling. And so if we can just go back to, you know, the spirit of old Iditarod, it would be so much better for everybody. And I'm always going to be a proponent of dogs first and Alaska first. And if it's the Iditarod or the Quest or the Cusco or the Kobuk, no race should be better than any other race. It should all be about celebrating the lifestyle of an Alaskan and celebrating dogs. And for me, that's what it will always be about. I don't even know if I want to – I probably won't even bring a phone just because I'm not really into technology and I don't really care about putting your dogs on treadmills and stair steppers and hyperbaric chambers. And if those guys think they're better mushers because they win a race, I don't really care about being a champion. I want to be a dog mom. Just because
right.
you win a race doesn't make it, you know, it's just – should be about, I think I've already explained myself enough, but it just sets me off. I just get depressed, to be quite honest. It's just it's tough.
You know, I knew that's what you were going to say. That's the reason I asked, because it's almost the exact opposite of everything else that everybody else is writing, at least, you know, the quote-unquote more famous folks that are writing these articles or blog posts or whatever they are. So I had a pretty good idea what you were going to say. Anyway, that's why I asked the question. But my follow-up question to that is not necessarily about dogs and, you know, the sort of the spirit of the race, but what do you think about how the Iditarod or Yukon Quest or whatever advances into the future? You know, the NFL is so much different now. It's much faster, much stronger than it was even in the 80s or 90s. You know, things have evolved so much. What do you think is able to evolve besides the dogs with either race now that they're adding other ways to, you know, whether it's phones or whatever else? How do you see it evolving, and is that good or bad?
It is what it is, man. I'm more and more worried about Mother Nature than what people behind closed doors are up to. But hopefully what I believe in and what the majority of mushers believe in are two completely opposite things. I'm pretty much, in a way, the Don Quixote when it comes to that race. A lot of folks obviously
right.
don't see eye to eye with me, but I would prefer to see more mandatory rest, to be quite honest, especially on the coast, and make it floating and not in a certain checkpoint. Make it a certain amount of hours you got to do on the coast, and the way things are being done right now, we might have to even relook how many dogs you're allowed to finish with at the finish line, because
right.
I mean, for mushers, it's a system, and obviously, I mean, hats off to Dallas, he knows exactly what he's doing, and he's great at it, but to the general public around the world, to see tiny teams, and I've finished with small teams before, it doesn't look as pretty as seeing a bunch of mushers coming in with bigger squads, and I think it would be better to have this floating mandatory amount of rest, just because I think you'd have more dogs making it to Nome. I mean, that's the number one reason I'd say why we have less dogs going to Nome is the pressure and the pace of the race. Obviously, are
right.
getting amped up year after year.
You know, speaking of Mother Nature, and you know, a lot of has changed in the last 3 or 4 years, and really in the last 5 years. I remember when I was here, my first couple of winters, we had so much snow into late, you know, late March, early April. We were still on sleds down here in Willow well into late April, early May. And now here we are at the beginning of June, and we've had no snow on the ground for a couple of months. And I ask you this because just today in the Alaska Dispatch, some big snowboard store was closing down. A big retailer
wow.
in Anchorage, and they'd said, you know what, we just can't do it anymore. Our sales dropped 49% just in the last, you know, in this last winter. Compared
no
to
pun,
the one
no
before.
Pun intended.
Right, right. So if the stores are closing and they're saying, oh my God, you know, we don't have winter anymore, how in the world can mushing continue, especially down here much further south than where you are? How in the world are folks going to be able to train or whatever, even some of the mid-distance races or you know, the Kinnick and, you know, the Northern Lights, et cetera, et cetera? what do you see happening with those kind of things? I mean, we can only do it so often before, as qualifiers, you know, all the weeks are kind of used up. How do you see that sort of playing out? And I know I'm kind of putting you in a forecasting mode here, but what do you think is going to happen with Mother Nature, regardless of rules and all that other stuff? As you mentioned, Mother Nature is the biggest threat to anything, I think, and I think you do as well.
Yeah. I'm a big proponent, and hopefully there's folks that are forward-oriented thinking that are coming up with game plans to create more mid-distance racing in villages. I've talked to numerous villagers from Manly to Tanana to Hooslea and all points in between there would be into it if we could figure out a way to get some support, not only financially, but logistically. I was talking with one of the Reddington boys the other day, talking about how it's really amazing how the Quest can not only do the Quest, but do the Quest 300 as well. And I think maybe Iditarod needs to take a look at how they can help support more smaller races so we can get a bigger variety of qualifying races. Or else it's really not fair for people trying to get into the sport. And you're going to see a sport that's going to be basically controlled by about half a dozen kennels, which is, it's always been controlled by the older families. That's what Iditarod's about, is the old school families. But it always needs new blood in there that does well, the Jeff Kings, the Martin Boozers back in the day. You're not seeing that as much anymore. We've got some great guys. I mean, I think guys like Nick Petit and some of these newer guys that are coming even from foreign countries, you know. The Norwegians proved how great they were this year. Getting mushers that are competitive from all over the country is just going to add more character to the race, and that's really what we need to concentrate on, is, you know, what the fans want to see. It's not just about setting records and how much money a musher makes. It's about the characters and the stories that make Iditarod and dog mushing as unique as it is.
Do you think a lot of those smaller kennels can afford to go to places like Manly or McGrath or whatever, where there tends to be snow, where you're saying some of these races should be held? Do you think that's financially viable for a lot of these really up-and-coming, whether it be for the Quest or for Iditarod? Do you think that's in the cards for them, or are they sort of going to get a washout, like you mentioned, because they don't have the money as the big guys do?
Yeah, it's a tough predicament. I mean, it's part of the thing with dog mushing is, I think we'll all come to the agreement that it's not really a sport you get into to become, you know, profitable. It's something you do because you really love doing it. So it's going to be tough, you know, but there was a guy named Hugh Neff that moved to Alaska with $200 to his name, didn't know anybody, and he just did his 28,000-mile race since 2000. So it is possible. You just got to have a love for what you're doing. And, you know, one thing I learned from experience is the more worried you are about making your dogs famous or well-known or taken care of, the better you're going to do in the long run. Don't worry about making yourself some great musher. There's a lot of people who like to put their names out there about, you know, how special and unique they are or whatever. But make your dogs unique. Make it the sole focus, always the dogs, and you'll do good in this sport. It just might not be the path you chose or the way you thought things would happen, but if you persevere, whether you do a 1,000-mile race or a 100-mile race or a 10-mile race, if you're enjoying it and you're doing it, you know, to the best of your abilities, then you're a winner. And don't ever feel sorry for yourself or look down on yourself because you didn't get that belt buckle or that Quest patch. You just got to live the life. And if you're not living the life and enjoying it, then what are you doing it for, is my question.
Right. Excellent commentary for sure from Hugh there. So, Hugh, let's end on a happy note. We have a few minutes left. I've been following along on your kennel pages there and with Nicole posting lots of pictures of puppies there back at the house. Tell us about some of those dogs. We always like to talk about at least one dog on your show. We've talked a little bit about George and Walter, but tell us about the future there at your home in Toke. What are they doing? How old are they? What's up with those little guys?
Well, obviously, Nicole's here right now. Our neighbor Bonnie's taking care of the dogs, the puppies now, and they're doing good. They're going on 3 months. I have a lot of them named after different characters that I know that I've met throughout my life. The next litter we're going to actually name after New Orleans names or Louisiana names. So we're going to have a Cajun, a Creole, Bayou, Olivier. So we're going to have that type of NOLA theme to our next litter.
Cool.
And that litter actually is going to be out of my main leader, Rosalita, and Stevie Ray's the father. So that is going to be my first breeding of Stevie. I've been basically, primarily we've been concentrating on breeding Bodie dogs or Lester, the John Baker lines from Kotzebue. But this next litter is also a tied to John's dog, Sport, who was his famous dog, Sutton's brother, when he won the year he won. I mean, if you ever look at John's pages, these dogs are like so beautiful. Anyhow, going to have a lot of energy and looking forward to it. You know, it's the best part about getting back is it's time to train puppies and talk to tourists. And summers for most mushers are just, you know, a grind. We all are just dreaming about getting back in the sled again. But the one thing I'm lucky above all mushers in is I just get to spread my incredible energy and passion for the dogs and show it to everyone else. And hopefully, whether they be mushers or first-time novices like Jacoby Jones, you can see they feel the energy and they really get into the adventurous party dog mushing. Not necessarily the competition, but just the mystery of being out in the middle of the night at 40 below and looking at the auroras and floating down the trail. I think that's what people really get into when it comes to dog mushing.
Awesome. So, Hugh, I usually ask you this question towards the end of every school tour, and I hope to have a different answer every time I ask. But my question has always been, has there been one unique or outstanding question from any of the kids or any of the folks that were at your talk? Did anybody ask anything that you've never heard before? Do you recall?
How many steps does a dog take to finish the Iditarod Trail?
Oh, my God.
You figure that one out, buddy. Yeah. That was like a little third grader. I just looked at her like, ask somebody who might, I don't know, maybe Ken Anderson or somebody who's really scientific like that, really into numbers might have a good answer for that. But that was a pretty good one.
Did you give her an answer? You can't really leave a third grader hanging.
No, I just basically said the same old, every year is different, we have different trails, and you never know how the rivers are going to set up, so you never know. Also, every dog obviously has a different length to their run. So,
right.
But it's fascinating what kids get, the questions they get in their heads.
I would bet it's well over a couple of million steps. I have no idea, but I guess we could figure it out with a Fitbit or something if we had to.
I would one of these years. I don't know if I could do the whole trail, but I wouldn't mind doing one of those walk deals. Just so I think all mushers should once in a while get out on their trails and bike them or walk them or jog them, just to have a healthier respect for what their dogs are doing. Makes you realize how amazing these huskies are.
Hey, I take my hats off to those dudes that that do the fat bike the entire way. I mean, you're literally...
Ladies, yeah.
I did a 25K fat bike this winter, and, man, you're literally pedaling every single... Imagine riding a bike from Anchorage to Nome. I mean, you know, on the back of the sled, you know, we're getting a relative break when we're standing on the runners, unless we're off the runners, you know, running or kicking or pedaling or whatever we're doing. But those dudes, I mean, you got to be fit to do stuff like that, don't you?
That equation is actually affecting the race, to be quite honest. We're getting lots and lots of traffic on the Iditarod Trail. Time of year.
Right.
I just remember some bike after bike the last couple of days on the coast, and there's many days where I was hardly ever even alone, and I wasn't even near any other mushers. It was just snow machine traffic and bike traffic. It's definitely getting a little bit more busy out there.
And, you know, just to bring this full circle, we talked about the snow snowboard shop closing, and they said in that article, yeah, nobody's buying cross-country skis or snowboards anymore. Everybody's buying fat bikes because that's something you can do with relatively no snow as long as you have something out there. You know, that's becoming the new recreation activity here in Alaska. So, unfortunately, I think there's going to be more of those folks out there on the Iditarod Trail and every other trail out there, whether you're training or running. But I think that's the new Alaska in terms of climate change. So, Hugh, we are out of time. I want you to travel safe. Maybe we'll hook up when you're in Anchorage for a day or two, however long you're staying up here. Otherwise, we'll see you next time. How's that?
All right, Doc. Good to hear your voice, Robert. And you have a good journey when you tour the country on your roller coaster tour.
Likewise. I'll talk to you soon. So on behalf of my co-host today, Hugh Neff, we'll talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.